Yep. It's KFEI Community Radio, 90.3 FM and HD in Minneapolis, St. Paul. All shows online within an hour of broadcast at KFAI.org. It's about a minute after 1 p.m. Central Standard Time. You just heard Democracy Now!, which broadcasts Monday through Friday, high noon. It's 1 o'clock on a weekday afternoon. That means it's locally produced public affairs this Friday. That means it's time for Catalyst, your weekly show of politics and culture. And we're finding out what people are doing in a post-George Floyd protest Minneapolis and beyond. You're listening to Catalyst, your weekly show of politics and culture. I'm your host, Lydia Howell, with...
with Rico Morales. That's right. I'm the co-host as well. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening.
And we have on the line Michelle Gross, who's been spending decades, like about 31 years, working on police accountability. She's president of Communities United Against Police Brutality, which started in 1999. Welcome to KFEI again, Michelle.
Thanks for having me today. Always a pleasure.
First off, I guess because there's no way we're going to get to all of them, I want to let people know a couple of times that they can see all the recommendation and data that you've collected in a report called What Will It Take to End Police Violence, which is on the website for Communities United Against Police Brutality, which is at CUAPB.org. And I'll say that again at least a couple of times in the course of this show. After things blew up with the torture murder of George Floyd, the Minneapolis City Council, their first thing was they had a vote and said, we'll dismantle the police. And then 2 or 3 days later, they said, we're just kind of got to go for defunding, but we're going to defund and put some money elsewhere. And then now their latest thing that I heard City Council President Lisa Bender say, we're going to have a conversation for the next year about what we might do about the police. So I was hoping that maybe, because people are freaking out about this whole defund the police thing, keeping it kind of local, I'm sure there are differences elsewhere, but keeping it to Minneapolis and Minnesota, give people a reality check on how the change can be made. It seems like there's different powers or lack thereof at the city level, the state level. There's always the police federation. I will not call them a union. Give people kind of a starting point on this.
Well, sure. Okay. First of all, one of the things that you know, I'd like to point out here is the role of the city council. Just in a formal way, they oversee they have the power of the purse, but they actually don't oversee the police. The power to oversee the police is actually given to the mayor in our city charter. And under our city charter, we're required to have police. That's hardwired in the charter. And we're required to have a floor of how much we fund the police. And it's a weird formula. It's 0.0017 times the population, and that's how many police we're required to pay for. And so that actually means that we're required to pay for 723 officers, given our current population, or thereabouts. Okay. And again, those are hardwired into the charter. To change that would require a charter change. In the meantime, though, sort of on an informal basis, you know, we have been going to this city council. And, you know, some of them have come in from previous councils and whatnot. We've been going to these folks for decades, for years and years and years, with things they needed to do, things they should have been doing to address policing in this community. And they were not interested. So, for example, we have been talking to them seven and a half, almost 8 years now ago. They created this Office of Police Conduct Review. They got into a civilian review, created this other office because they needed an accountability mechanism that was acceptable to the cops. Well, any mechanism that's acceptable to the cops that's going to oversee their accountability isn't going to oversee their accountability, okay? So we were pretty upset with that, saying, are you kidding us? So basically,
and this was after this outfit. We did have a civilian review board that had been voted into existence by we the
correct.
People
correct and they gutted it and
then created and so this then office that the police department wanted.
Yeah, so then they created this Office of Police Conduct Review that's controlled on every level by city staff and police. So there's no levels of real actual civilian oversight of the police anymore. And this office has an abysmal record. They have a 0.46% sustain rate or discipline rate of their complaints. They've taken in, you know, probably almost 3,000 complaints at this point, and they have sustained and disciplined 12 of them in 7.5, almost 8 years. So, you know, it's pretty abysmal record at this point. And we've been telling the city council, you need to pay attention to this. A guy like Derek Chauvin would not have continued to work for the Minneapolis Police Department if his all of the multiple complaints against him had been addressed properly. I am absolutely convinced of that.
So, can you help me understand, help listeners understand? I think everyday people who are not, you know, ensconced in this issue for years and years, like you have been, like I've been, don't get why is an officer allowed to continue on the job with 18 complaints, 3 shootings before he torture murdered George Floyd? We've been told forever it's just a few bad apples, but they never do anything about the bad apples. Why?
Right. And that's because it's a bad system, okay? And the system is a self-protective system. So the city in Minneapolis is self-insured for police complaints and, you know, and lawsuits and settlements and judgments. It's self-insured. So if they ever sustain complaints on the officers, it's going to make it look like those are bad officers, and that's going to enhance the value of lawsuits. So instead of sustaining complaints, oh, the other thing it does is when they sustain complaints, those complaints and more of the detail of those complaints becomes public data, including like what the allegations were and what kind of discipline they got and things like that. All of that becomes public data if you sustain and discipline a complaint and it gets past the grieve period. So this is, you know, big incentive for them to never sustain these complaints because they want to hide them, and also because they don't want to make them look like they have any merit, because if they have merit, then lawsuits become more valuable. And so this is all about tamping everything down as opposed to actually addressing police conduct. And so, you know, the system is very self-protective. And this has been the way this has been done for years and years and years. And
can so you take on the Federation, the Police Federation? Because I get the sense that somehow they've managed, I don't know if it's in the contract, I don't know if it's as a lobbying outfit to the state legislature. They seem to have created a situation where it's other layers and twists and turns that make it impossible to hold police accountable.
You know what? I'm going to disagree with you on that. And believe it or not, I think, you know, Bob Kroll is like a clown, basically. He's like a cartoon character. He's racist and he's a creep. And the Federation, you know, defends dirty cops no matter what. So there's no questions. I'm not in love with the Federation. No, nothing like that. But if you spend the time to look at their contract like we have, you know, we spent months and months and months going through every part of that contract. We came up with 14 recommendations for changes to the contract. But the reality is their disciplinary process and arbitration is pretty standard compared to other. It's a federation because it involves both line staff and management, but it's essentially a union, you know, but it's a federation. But the bottom line is that the discipline for this police federation is not out of line with other union contracts at all. The issue, and the city does not want to admit this, is that police leadership fails to address police, you know, misconduct so widely that when they finally do get ready to, they can't discipline the officer because of past practices. The issue is like this. Okay, you get a guy, they do something bad, you fire them. Now, it goes to arbitration, and when it goes to arbitration, the arbitrator says, oh, there were these 7 or people of the same conduct. You never disciplined them, or you never fired them. You know, you just gave them a slap on the wrist. So why are you firing this guy? That's unfair. And they're not wrong. The problem is that we don't address the conduct with everybody in a consistent manner, with, appropriate documentation and all of that kind of stuff. So we've been talking for a long time about a thing called the disciplinary reset mechanism that puts a stake in the ground and that says from this point forward, the discipline is going to be consistent It's going to be, you know, appropriate. We've got an outline of what the discipline's going to be, so you know in advance. And if you engage in misconduct, you're going to get this discipline. Arbitrators would uphold something like that. But our problem is that we have wildly different disciplines for different people. It's political. It's not, you know, they shoot themselves in the foot with the stuff they do. It's actually not the arbitrators, and it's not even the union contract.
It's leadership.
Is it poor leadership?
Yes, it is. It's poor leadership that's not handled well.
That we voted for leaders that are not really necessarily doing what we were hoping for them to do.
Well, we're talking the police leadership.
We don't actually vote for.
Thank you.
You know, it's their people, and so you know, it starts with the chief, and it goes all the way down the line. And you have to have. It's just like anything. You can't, if you're a supervisor of any group of employees, and you've got a person that's coming in late every day, and they get to their 8th or 10th day that they came in late or whatever, and that's a problem. You don't just go, okay, now you're fired. By documenting the late. The tardiness, so then you have to sit down and say, now look, you know, you're tardy every day and you have to, you know, come in on time, and here's the consequences if this continues, blah, blah, blah. And you have to do, you know, the kind of stepwise discipline, you know, and you have to have, you know, and you can't just wait until day 27 and they're late and you know, you're fired, you know, especially when you've got a union. You have to document those things and you have to walk through the process. When we fail to do that, then the arbitrator is not going to uphold that kind of discipline, and they shouldn't.
So the problem has been a failure of police leadership, chiefs, and supervisors, because they have been so inconsistent, so reluctant to discipline, that, you know, somebody has to be so over the top and public outcry has to be so loud. Okay, we'll get rid of this one guy. But then they can't even do that. I mean, it also seems even when civil courts affirm a lawsuit saying an officer was brutal or, you know, used excessive force, even a lawsuit cannot get somebody fired, which kind of ticks me off, because I just always think, if I'd ever cost my employer tens of thousands of dollars or $1 million or $3 million, something tells me I wouldn't have a job, you know?
Well, no kidding. I mean, that's how it works in the real world with the rest of us. Now, I want to give you kind of an example about this. In St. Paul, on his second day on the job, Chief Axtell attempted to fire officer named Brett Palkowicz. And Brett Palkowicz is the guy who basically kicked the living daylights out of Frank Baker. This was a man that was just the wrong guy. He just happened to come through the area and was attacked by a police dog when they were looking for somebody else. He basically had back his leg eaten off by the dog. And Palkowicz runs up and starts kicking him in his eyes, and he collapsed his lungs on both sides. And this man very nearly died. But for very good paramedic care and hospital care, he would have died. And so Axtell, and there was no basis for it. You know, the guy hadn't committed any crime. It was excessive force all down the line. So Axtell, on his second day on the job, fires Palkowicz, but the arbitrator reinstated him. And when he did, he said, you know, here's the problem. There's these 6-7 incidents that we can name where these officers did not get disciplined at all or had minimal discipline, and now you're firing this guy. And when they named all of those incidents, 4 out of the 6 were Palkowicz.
So I don't get it. He's saying, what, because when it was the chief's second day on the job, he didn't name all these other previous incidents that Palkowicz had done?
No, they were saying it's by the department. It's not by the chief. In other words, all that time, the department had never disciplined. Now this new chief comes in and tries to discipline, and he was hamstrung by past practices. So we talked to him about the disciplinary reset, and he glommed onto it. He loved it. He's applied it, and his arbitrations are actually sticking. You know, he is actually being able to have his discipline stick. And this is an important concept, because when disciplines don't stick, it disempowers the chief.
Yeah.
And so they need their disciplines to stick, right?
Well, and it seems like culture will not change without some top-down leadership, as far as I can tell. I mean,
that's exactly it. They have to do a great job of documenting the conduct. You know, they have to try to, you know, coach and counsel people out of that conduct if it's not super serious. They need to address problems early. There's 100 things they need to be doing right now. And that's, you know, I want to get to the talking about, like, this whole business of, you know, getting
defunding.
Rid of the police department versus defunding versus whatever the heck it is now. I want to get to talking about that because the problem that we have with our city council is they want to go straight to disbanding the police when they know they don't actually have the power to do it.
So and it's nonsense. It's BS for the public, hoping as memories fade from the George Floyd torture murder and in the aftermath will mm-hmm. accept. Do they have at least the power to say there's some things police shouldn't be doing? So when you have a mental health crisis, we're not, and you call 911, we're going to send a mental health team, not the cops. And
there's some things there's some things they'd have to do, and particularly they'd have to work with the county on that, because 911 function for the Minneapolis police is within the Minneapolis Police Department. But what we really need is to have dispatch triage at the county level, because the mobile mental health crisis teams are all at the county level. And so what we need is to make sure that in every county in the state has one of these teams, which is very good. The infrastructure is already there. What we need is to move the decision about whether or not to dispatch those teams up a higher level to have this thing called dispatch triage.
I mean, if we took more things out of the hands of police, and I don't know if the city council has that power, but if we decided being homeless isn't a crime, you don't need a cop, you need a place to live. You know, if we said, I mean, fewer interactions with police means less brutality, you know, fewer right. opportunities, you know, to be bashed or choked out or shot. And police aren't the people to be addressing this stuff. And I know that's what defund the police really means, is can we, you know, not use the police for every social problem we have? I mean, is that possible?
Right. And that's what we've been pushing for years now. You know, we've been trying to get that to happen. They don't act. There are some things that they have to put into place to make that happen, and they have to work with the county, because, again, one of the problems that happens is when things come through 911 dispatch at the Minneapolis level, they're going to the police, and the police are deciding who are the appropriate responders. And the police like to keep a lot of things for themselves. So we actually need to try to move up that decision to a higher level, so that instead of seeing it as everything threading through the police, that we've got, like, okay, here's fire, here's police, here's mental health crisis team, here's the homeless response team, or whatever they would be called, or, you know, and here's, you know, the overdose, you know, we're going to send those to EMS and let them deal with it. You know, instead everything single threads through the cops, and then they decide who else they want to call in. And that's just too many steps far down. We need to be bringing that decision up higher. So that's something that would have to happen in conjunction with the county. So there is, you know, but they do have some power to do that, yes. And they have the power to make sure that there's adequate funding for these alternate responders. So they do have that power. What they don't have the power is to lower the floor of how many police we have below the level that's required under the charter. And they don't have the power to disband the police department, because, again, it's hardwired in the charter. They would have to get a charter change. And at this point, there wouldn't be one until 2021 to even get on the ballot. It's too late in the year to get it on the ballot for 2020. They just don't have the capacity to do that.
So they were just blowing smoke. Yeah. We're having a conversation with Michelle Gross, president of Communities United Against Police Brutality, an organization that's been working since 1999 in Minneapolis, St. Paul, looking for police accountability and pushing every pressure point on the body politic. I want to encourage people to go to Communities United Against Police Brutality's website,
yes,
which is CUAPB.org, and click on this report, What Will It Take to End Police Violence? Because while we can have great slogans, that ain't going to get it. There's been a great deal of work done around the country and a great deal of research. And I know that Michelle Gross and other members of CUAPB have put together a heck of a report. I've read it myself. Michelle, we're closing out now. Your final comments. Is CUAPB still having its weekly meetings in the midst of the pandemic?
We do, but we do them by a conference call. And that's, we want everybody to feel safe. I personally can't wait till we get back to doing them in person because it's easier. But, we're managing and we're getting a lot of work done. And we are pushing for the kinds of changes that need to happen now, not in 2021. So we were at the legislature this morning trying to push for some bills better than what they've decided that they're going to let come to the floor. We need real bills that actually will create an agency to directly investigate and prosecute police, get it outside of the BCA and the county attorneys and all that. So we're pushing for a lot of changes, a lot of things that we need to have happen right now.
And primarily at the state legislature? Is that on the CUAPB website where people can see and weigh in, like call their state rep or state senator?
We're getting there. They just released the bills and haven't even finalized the text of some of them. So we are, the legislature opened at noon today for their special session. We will be putting stuff up very shortly with our analysis of bills. Most of the bills are so-so. There's a couple of good ones, and there's a few really bad ones. So we're going to be putting our analysis up shortly of things that we want the legislature to do, and we'll also be sending that out in our newsletter. So I encourage people to sign up.
Right, get the newsletter.
Get on our mailing list.
If you get the newsletter, y'all don't, I can attest, you don't send out boatloads of stuff. But when you do, it's real information, and there's always an action. Thank you, Michelle Gross, Communities United Against Police Brutality. If you have been hurt by the police, you can call the hotline 24/7, 612-874-7867. That's 612-874-7867. It's also on the website, CUAPB.org. Thank you so much, Michelle. Again, there is, there's been people working on this for a long time, and there is much to be done. I think that's a momentous moment. But we have some good news. Rico's going to bring you the organizers of this year's Juneteenth. It is happening, which I'm so glad.
And I am Rico Morales. Good afternoon, everyone. It is 1:31 p.m. on a beautiful day. Hey, this is Catalyst every Friday from 1 until 2 p.m. on KFAI Fresh Air Community Radio. I have some great announcements. Juneteenth celebration, Unite and Rebuild MSP, Minneapolis-St. Paul, is happening Friday, June 19th, 3 p.m. to 8 p.m. And it's at the Minnehaha Center, open lot near Lake Street and Target, 2872 26th Avenue. It's going to be hosted by several different organizers and groups and communities. It's a family-friendly Juneteenth celebration. And more than ever now, we are needing to rebuild these cities and this neighborhood. Juneteenth is also known as Freedom Day, Jubilee Day, as an American holiday celebrated on June 19th since 1865 to celebrate and announce the end of slavery. Also, I have Monique Chenier on the interview, as well as Misha Bartlett. And we interviewed together. Here is that audio. And hello, everyone. My name is Rico Morales. We are recording from KFAI, Fresh Air Community Radio, at KFAI.org. I am speaking with Monique Chenier. Is that how you pronounce your name?
Yeah, that's exactly correct.
And could you introduce yourselves, please? What is your role in the community, Monique?
Yeah, so I am Monique Chenier. I'm helping to lead an effort to help unite and rebuild MSP. And so I've had the fortunate of meeting a variety of community, nonprofit, and faith leaders over the last several weeks and just igniting the passion that we have in helping to rebuild our city.
And Misha Bartlett, can you introduce yourself, please?
Absolutely. I'm Misha Bartlett.
Great. Thank you very much. Monique, can you tell me if I have the right LinkedIn information? You're the senior HR manager at Target. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I'm one of many.
One of many. Yeah, you're not the only one responsible for everything, right?
Oh, no. There's 400,000 employees at Target, so it takes a lot of amazing people. But yes, I'm one of many senior HR managers for Target Corp, actually located here in Minneapolis.
Do you live in Minneapolis or St. Paul? I mean, roughly what neighborhood?
Yeah, I live in Plymouth, but I did grow up here in the New Hope area. I've lived in several other places, but I'm born and raised Minnesotan. And so although I leave, I always come back because my family's here and I believe in this community.
And you believe in this community. And so what were your feelings or thoughts or perceptions or opinions about the recent events with the Minneapolis Police Department and the local communities that are suffering and have always been suffering for a while? Could you tell us a little bit what you're doing recently this coming week for this event that's happening? And could you tell us the name of it?
Yeah, definitely. And so the event is Unite and Rebuild MSP. And so it's planned for June 19th in celebration of Juneteenth at the Minnehaha Center open lot, which is actually near the Target Lake Street store. And so we've been fortunate to have city officials and community leaders that are embracing the efforts we need to rebuild and provide empowerment and just help and hope to that community. And so we embrace that space and bring a celebration with community leaders, musical artists, food trucks, which, you know, gotta have food, which is a big appeal for people. And so it will be June 19th from 3 p.m. to 8 p.m. At Minnehaha Center. So for me personally, unfortunately, the murder of George Floyd and the systemic racism, the injustice, that is not new. That is something I've been keenly aware of as a Black woman, particularly a Black woman that's grown up in Minnesota. I've been blessed to have a very educated family who, from my great-grandparents to grandparents to parents, have really taught me I have to believe in myself and I have to try hard because the system is not necessarily rooting for me. And so I've taken a hold of that. And so with everything happening with George Floyd's murder, honestly, every time it situations like that happen in the news, I ask myself and tell myself I want to do something, but I'm never sure what to do. And I think that's a question a lot of people have asked themselves and are asking themselves even today. But with George Floyd, this happened 20 minutes from where I live. And so I knew I couldn't sit still and needed to do something, even though I didn't know what that was. But I thought, there's a need. People need food. They need diapers. They need donations. So let me start there. And so I went into the community. I always bring something with me. I don't believe in let's just show up, take pictures and leave. Like, let's contribute. Let's show up for our neighbors. And through that, started having conversations of this area, particularly on Lake Street, needs healing amongst a lot of other communities. And so honestly, those conversations manifested into who do we know? How do we empower people? Particularly because I think developers very quickly will want to get into that neighborhood. And I think the better answer is how do we equip people and empower people that are there to have their essential basic needs right now, but build onto that so this community can honestly rise out of the ashes. And so through that, all those conversations have led to planning this Juneteenth event. And putting the energy and passion and talent of so many people into bringing our community together.
So I'm going to ask a little bit more of a pushback question here, a little softly. How do people like myself or others who are just learning about this information, learning about this event, I'm just recently been told or been helpful with this event. How do I get not just a spot or a tent, or what can I do to add? Maybe I have a suggestion for a band or a speaker, or is everything just already set in stone by the powers that be?
Such a great question. Thank you for asking. Everybody that's working on this is a volunteer. So even myself just jumping in, I'm passionate, trying to lend my talents and then asking other talented people. So the big things we need right now are people's willingness. And so we'll need volunteers. We will need individuals who will bring donations with them, such as food, diapers, baby formula. There's such a huge need because a lot of the grocery stores and stores that people would access in the community are no longer there, unfortunately. And then, of course, money. We are wanting to make this a safe and sanitized environment. And so with anything that is nonprofit, we are working with little to no budget. And so even just accepting donations so we can make sure we have things like masks and hand sanitizer to make it a safe environment for people. And so we do have a Facebook event page. It's under Juneteenth Celebration. And so that's how people can access it.
So this is a drop-off site as well, where people can drop off and pick up supplies or groceries or free stuff?
That's correct. We're working with a nonprofit called Mother's Love. And so we'll have a food pantry set up where people can donate and bring supplies and much needed equipment. And then also those in the community can pick it up as well.
Thank you. I'll have Misha Bartlett ask some questions. Misha, do you have some questions or some more thoughts?
I do. Do you want to talk to us a little bit about what's going on with the lineup and who might be celebrating? I know music has been such an incredible thing. I've been entrenched. This is my neighborhood. This is my community. I grew up here. I still live in it. I drive those streets every day where these horrible things happened over the last few weeks. And I've stood there among the ashes, inhaling the smoke, just really broken about what's going on. And as we progressed through the anger and moved towards Memorial, I have found that music is filling the streets, and we see it happening all over the world right now. And it's such a beautiful thing. It really is the most universal language. And so just tell us a little bit about what the lineup in the day is going to look like and what people can expect.
Yeah, such a good question. And I agree with you. And that's a big reason where I was like, oh, we need healing, and music brings people together. It is, I think, a beautiful global language. But then also for those of us in the Black community, like, you think of your family reunions and things you do, music is such a core component of that. So we've been really fortunate to be able to have partners at First Ave be willing to step in and help with sound engineering production. And so just so blessed to have them in this partnership. And so they have a number of different artists that cover from jazz musicians to Prince cover bands, which we all, if it's the Minnesotans, love Prince. And so to be honest, this is a work in progress. And so we will release names of artists early next week, but it's a lot of people who have played in the Twin Cities, beloved in the Twin Cities, have been active in the community, and then even have performed at First Ave that we're lining up.
That's great. I think it's so important that we keep that local right now and central to what's going on in this city, in Minneapolis. It's, I guess, why Prince never could leave, because it's such a wealth of amazing talent and community. And to be honest with you, pretty much everybody that is here and still playing here, I mean, one way or another, has sort of been born of those waters of Prince. So that's very exciting. Very exciting to hear.
So Monique, yeah. Thank you. This is Rico again. Will you be at the volunteers and the organizers meeting tomorrow morning?
I will be, yeah. So we'll be meeting at the open space from 10 to noon tomorrow. So I definitely will be there, because we've got a lot of work yet to do. And so doing everything I can to make this successful and doing it because I believe in bringing healing to the community.
What do you think, Rico? Should we share a little song that was done here locally by some really great luminaries that was created for another project that we did for hurricane relief a couple years back after all of that disaster. And it's such a beautiful representation and a messaging, I think, that really applies right now and can give us some hope and lift. And so we'd love to share with you Never Give Up. It's a song that was, again, done by Julius Collins, T. Michael Rambo, Kat Perkins, Jesse Larson, and Jamesia Bennett, you'll hear on this track.
What are we to do? There's so many people hopeless. No shelter and no food. So we've got to think that no good comes from doubt. To hear people sing is a beautiful thing. Then goodwill comes about.
When we come together, hand in hand, it's true. We've got to care for those in need of us. There's so much work to do. Never give up, even when you lost your way. When your world comes apart, look into your heart and say,
again. Hey, thank you very much to Misha Bartlett. She's the one who introduced that song and to me personally, and it's just a global, worldwide, it's a phenomenal song for a phenomenal moment. Any last final comments or suggestions or questions?
Well, one, it was a beautiful song that I think captures a lot of what we need our community and world to do today. To get more information about the efforts we are trying to do in Minneapolis, you can visit our webpage, which is will be up and running and have all the amazing details, which is uniteandrebuildmsp.com. And starting today, you'll be able to see a lot of great information. That's where people can get details if they want to be a vendor, participate in the food truck, if they want to volunteer, if they want to donate. All that great information will be available there. Again, that's uniteandrebuildmsp.com.
And Misha?
That's great. So we're very much then looking forward to the Juneteenth celebration on June 19th at the Minnehaha Center Open Lot. It really is a time for us to come together, unite, and never give up in our efforts to reclaim our beautiful city. And we're just happy to have you with us today. Monique, thank you for all of your efforts. And we look forward to all this collaboration this week.
And that was the interview with the organizers, Monique Chenier from Target and Misha Bartlett, also one of the volunteers for the Juneteenth celebration happening next week. More information will be posted momentarily. I am Rico Morales. I also have another interview here with Marty, John Marty, Representative State Senator John Marty from District 66 in Roseville. And here it is, that audio.
John Marty, State Senator from District 66, Roseville, and suburban communities and part of St. Paul, and a member of the Senate for many years now.
And how long have you been, when was your first year, how long have you been representative?
Okay, I've been in the Senate for over 30 years, since 1987.
Wow.
So very, very long term. It doesn't seem that long, but yes.
So what's happening this next week? You said that possibly or definitely the Minnesota State Congress is opening or is starting again?
Yes, the state Senate's opening up, or the state House and Senate. The legislature has been called into special session by Governor Walz. It's beginning today on Friday. And we'll be going for an undetermined amount of time. Usually when we have a special session, there's pre-agreed upon agenda. This was called because if the governor wants to extend the emergency authority and the legislature's not in session, the law requires him to call the legislature back so the legislature can have some chance to question it or whatever they want with it. So we are coming back in for that purpose. But obviously, there are a whole range of other issues related to COVID, related to the policing crisis in Minneapolis and around the state. There are a whole lot of other issues that are likely to come up, but it was called not to address a specific issue, but because the law requires the governor to do so in order to keep the COVID emergency in effect.
I see. And what have you heard or do you sense what possibly do you see any the governor leaning towards one way or the other? I mean, I'm not trying to let the cat out of the bag.
Yeah, sure. No, I think it's fair to say that the governor would like us to have a strong, long agenda this time. And I agree. I think the George Floyd murder and the following understandable uproar from it suggests the public is eager for us to start addressing some of these inherent racism issues in policing and other in housing and the whole economy. And yes, a special session isn't going to fix all the problems that some of us have been pushing to address for years, but it's a chance right now. You try and take advantage of the fact that there's public attention to it and use that political pressure to make something happen. So I think the governor is on board with that. I'm on board with that. I think a lot of us want to make sure we don't just say, oh, well, we can deal with it in the future. It's easy to say if you're not the victim of police, is not the victim of the policing. It's easy to say it's not a crisis if you're not affected by it. But every person of color and indigenous person in the state has, most of them have experienced the problems and they've been the victims of this. And the fact that people are saying no more, it's time for change. Let's act on that. Let's use that political clout. Let's use that pressure and act and try and make change now.
What did you think or how did you feel personally being at the site of 3759 Chicago Avenue the other day where I met you again?
Right. It was good to see you there. It's a powerful site, memorial. Because the whole world, last night they were talking about people in not just New York City, but people in England and South Africa and other places who are talking about George Floyd, and people who may never have heard of Minneapolis are talking about Minnesota now and Minneapolis. And when you're at that site, the first thing that comes to your mind is a decent human being who is being crushed by a totally insensitive person who basically just slowly tortured him to death. And I think we have to acknowledge that anybody who goes there is moved by that. I'm glad that was the first time I had been at that site since the death, and the tributes, the beautiful tributes. I talked to one woman who was picking up the posters because rain was expected later in the day, picking up the posters because they had so many powerful statements on them. We want to save these. This is part of our history now. And no, it was a very moving experience.
Thank you. Thank you. I am an employee of Cup Foods at 3759 Chicago. So it's been a lot. It's been quite a bit, but I do appreciate your help and support. And as a personal friend and a member of our similar communities, what do you see hopeful coming up this session, this special session? Do you have a couple projects or issues or proposals in hand?
Sure.
Or?
A couple of things. I have some of my own on this. And I mean, I think some of the most urgent ones are to make sure that we ban the police use of certain dangerous things that are killing people. When we are giving the police the ability to legally use certain tactics that end up killing people, people are going to die. And in this case, I mean, I think he was intentional. I think he was trying to crush him. I mean, the officer, that's what I think has driven the whole, it's waking up a whole lot of the population, especially the white population, who have never been. I'm white and I've never experienced discrimination because of my race. But it's woken up a lot of people who are seeing how callous and how uncaring and how my hands are in my pockets, but I'm scared of this guy, so I got to crush his neck. No, you're not sitting there nonchalantly staring off into space with your hands in your pockets. If you're scared to death, somebody's going to hurt you.
Yeah.
Callousness is, I think it woke up a lot of people who didn't believe this happens. And we know it's been happening year after year, day after day. And so I think that wake up has been very helpful. But so I want to make sure the first thing we do is we ban those dangerous policing techniques, the no-knock warrant where they're breaking down a door without telling people they're coming in. Those are situations that end up killing people. I have a couple of bills of my own that I want to add to the mix because they're not in the Minnesota legislature's Posse Caucus, as they're calling it, POCI, People of Color and Indigenous Caucus, is sort of taking the lead on this, which is very appropriate. And they've got a long list of agenda items. I'm adding a couple that I'd like to see happen as well, one of which is to ban Minnesota law enforcement agencies from taking these military weapons from the military, because there's a federal program that basically gives them to local law enforcement. And you know, what in the world does a law enforcement agency in Minnesota need a grenade launcher for? So my bill would ban things like that. That's one of the bills. Another one I have is, it relates to all the discussion, which means different things to different people, about defunding or disbanding the police. But one of the things I'd like to make the case for is that law enforcement officials have very specific training for very specific things. They are not experts in suicide prevention. They are not experts in mental health. They are not experts in addressing drug overdoses. They're not experts in a whole range of other things. And so what I'm proposing to do is have a state grant program to encourage local governments that would take money out of their police department and transfer into an alternative emergency responder program, which might have social workers, mental health workers, and others involved.
And that was Minnesota State Senator John Marty, represents suburbs around Minneapolis, including Roseville, interviewed by Rico Morales. Again, let me encourage you to go to CommunitiesUnitedAgainstPoliceBrutality.org. Look at their report, What Will It Take to End Police Violence. A lot of politicians are saying a lot of stuff right now, and it's important not to be bamboozled. Also, want to make sure that you know, again, next Friday, June 19th, is Juneteenth, Unite and Rebuild Minneapolis-St. Paul. Friday, June 19th, 3 p.m. to 8 p.m., Minnehaha at East Lake Street, in the parking lot of the Target store that's there in South Minneapolis, side of some of the protests. We don't want you to miss out. And Rico, what is the website for Juneteenth, Unite and Rebuild MSP?
It's uniteandrebuildmsp.com.
Okay. We're going to end with a couple of public service announcements, and then it's time for Corazon Latino, beautiful music from across Latin America, brought to you by Carla and Eve. Because, boy, we need the music to get through. I know I do. Peace out.